This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com.
In the summer of 1967, Joe Wilcox, who was 24 years old, led an expedition of 12 exemplary young men toward the summit of Alaska's Mount McKinley, now more commonly known as Denali, the tallest peak in North America. A storm hit, and only five men returned. Reckoning by lives lost, the tragedy was the third worst in mountaineering history when it occurred and remains North America's greatest expeditionary mountaineering disaster. What happened? The full and final answer to this bitterly debated question has eluded us until now. 40 years later, in Forever on the Mountain, author Jim Tabor guides us with authority and compassion along this gripping and inexplicably underreported story to the truth, both the facts and, most poignantly, the human drama underneath. Author Jim Tabor joins me on the long line. He's hosted the national PBS series The Great Outdoors and is currently a writer and executive producer for Journeys to the Center of the World, a History Channel presentation about caves. Good afternoon, Jim.
Good afternoon, Coy. Thanks very much for having me.
Absolutely. I've really been looking forward to this. What a story. I mean, my gosh. And I don't want to waste any of your time. Jim, let's get right to us. Tell us what happened.
Sure, I will. You know, your introduction very succinctly described why this event deserved to be called a tragedy. And one more figure will help to put that in perspective. In the 54 years of climbing that preceded the 1967 disaster, there had been four climbing fatalities on McKinley. And so this disaster almost doubled those in one fell swoop. So it was indeed an event of major proportions. What about the mystery and the controversy? Well, part of the mystery is obvious. The seven men who died, their bodies were never recovered, nor were any journals or diaries or photographs or anything that might have really shed substantial light on how they died and why they died. In addition, another mysterious fact was, despite the fact that they were trapped very near the summit for 10 days by just a monster storm, and despite the fact that authorities knew about that for 8 days, absolutely nothing was done to mount a rescue to try to help these fellows. So that added a whole other layer of mystery, and it was made even more difficult to understand when you realize that just 5 months earlier, when three men were trapped very nearly at the same place, within 11 hours of learning of their predicament, the government mounted an immense rescue operation that involved C-130 Hercules aircraft, they're called Hurricane Chasers, T-33 reconnaissance jets, Huey helicopters, and literally scores of civilian and military personnel. Yet, just 5 months later, with more than twice as many men trapped, nothing was done.
Why is that, Jim?
Well, there were a variety of reasons, and you might think that the controversy would have been generated by the fact that no rescue attempt was mounted. Well, quite the contrary, in fact. The controversy was engineered, really, to focus on the climbers themselves and their leader, and it was alleged by some that bad leadership and inexperience and ineptitude, but because of those things, the climbers almost engineered their own deaths. And so that misconception persisted until, gosh, as long as 1998, when a really famous mountaineering writer named Jonathan Waterman wrote in one of his books that if you asked any mountaineering expert what caused the 67 tragedy, their immediate answer would be, well, it was Joe Wilcox, the leader, of course. So that's kind of where the matter stood when I came onto the story and decided that more truth lay somewhere and needed to be discovered. But let me try to answer your question about why no rescue was mounted. There were a variety of reasons. First of all, the two men responsible for managing and administering the McKinley National Park, as it was known, were not mountaineers. They were career bureaucrats. They were good men. They were good civil servants, but they had no way of knowing and firsthand, viscerally understanding how badly the men trapped up high were suffering. That was one thing. Another thing was that in the aftermath of the rescue attempt that I described earlier, which was very large and very expensive, those two men had been criticized very violently in public by media and taxpayers for, quote, wasting taxpayers' money to rescue lunatic climbers. So they were quite gun-shy and doubtless, I think, saw perhaps their careers evaporating if they triggered another rescue before it absolutely, positively was required.
My guest is Jim Tabor. His new book is Forever on the Mountain, the truth behind one of mountaineering's most controversial and mysterious disasters at Mount McKinley in the summer of 1967. Jim, do you think Joe was inexperienced, the leader, the 24-year-old leader of this expedition? Was he at fault?
No, absolutely not. I have to tell you that he was an extremely experienced mountaineer before he set foot on McKinley. He had been mountaineering for a good 10 years, had climbed all the major northwest peaks, and most importantly, he had been a guide and a lead guide on Mount Rainier, which is the most challenging mountain we have in the lower 48 and everyone's logical stepping stone to McKinley. He had led a number of climbs by the most difficult routes up and down Rainier and done so safely. And so he was an extremely experienced climber and leader, and that, you know, that criticism just did not hold water. Other criticisms of similar nature were leveled at the climbers themselves, but I found that seven of the nine men in Joe's particular contingent were also very experienced climbers. They had climbed in the Alps, in Antarctica, on the big peaks in Mexico, Pacific Northwest, and they also had plenty of experience. So, you know, that criticism just didn't hold water, as I say.
Author Jim Tabor is my guest. The book is Forever on the Mountain, and keep listening, folks, and we'll give away a free copy of this book at the end of the interview. Jim, take us to the mountaintop, and just to put this in perspective, if I'm not mistaken, McKinley Denali is over 20,000 feet at the summit, which we're right here near the Blue Ridge, so it's over 10 times in the size of the Blue Ridge Mountains near us here in Charlottesville. Take us up there on that mountain. What was going on? Why is it that these experienced young men couldn't weather this storm? What happened?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about McKinley, because it's really a unique mountain. One famous mountaineering writer has said that there are two iconic peaks on Earth, Everest one and McKinley the other, and there's some really good reasons for that. It's true that McKinley is 20,000 feet high, but because it's so close to the Arctic Circle and our atmosphere is so much thinner near the poles, its real barometric altitude effect on the body is more like 23 or 24,000 feet as you would experience on Everest. In addition, it's 35 degrees of latitude farther north than Everest, and one great mountaineer, Peter Hackett, who has climbed both several times, has said that he found Everest tropical. That's his word, tropical by comparison. another thing is that McKinley is uniquely badly located in terms of meteorology. It's 160 miles due east of the Bering Sea, which is known as the birthplace of storms. And so huge, huge cyclonic storms brew up out there, and they come roaring across the tundra. And the first thing they hit is Mount McKinley, which sticks up like a huge rock in white water. So there's these variety of factors that make McKinley one of the most challenging, dangerous, and coveted peaks on Earth. All those factors combined with the primitive state of communication back in those days led to the men who died being trapped up near the summit by one of these monster storms. They did the right thing. They dug snow caves up at about 18,500 feet and said, well, we'll just hunker down. We'll wait for the storm to pass. Unfortunately, it turned out to be the worst storm in recorded McKinley history to that point. It lasted almost 10 days with 150 mile an hour sustained winds, many feet of snow, temperatures that dropped off the bottom of the wind chill chart, and it's not likely, quite frankly, that anyone would have survived that. As several of the survivors said to me when I interviewed them a couple of years ago.
Jim Tabor is my guest. The book is Forever on the Mountain. Was it just a matter of you know, they're down in these caves in this blizzard on this mountain? Was it simply a matter that they couldn't get out? They couldn't dig their way out?
Well, it wasn't so much that. They at 18,500 feet, they were. I'm sure they were able to keep the snow from blocking them in. But the McKinley at that level on that particular route is very, very exposed. And if you had gone out of a cave and tried to down climb in those conditions, you literally would have been blown off the mountain. Just and that has happened to other climbers. Another factor is that if you're trapped in your main camp by a storm like that, you have lots of fuel to melt water, you have lots of food, things like that to get you through. When these guys were coming down from their summit attempt, and they were traveling very lightly, they had sleeping bags and snow shovels and enough supplies, you know, to get them up the mountain, I mean up to the summit, down to the summit, and maybe sustain them for a day or two. But when all that ran out, they began to decline very quickly because you dehydrate very rapidly at high altitude. And the more you dehydrate, the worse altitude sickness becomes. So it was just a situation of diminishing returns the longer they had to stay up there.
The book is Forever on the Mountain. It is a hell of a story. And the author is Jim Tabor. Jim, for the folks who came down, the few men who survived, what stories did they bring with them?
Well, it's such an interesting thing. There were five survivors, of course. Two of the men, Howard Snyder and leader Joe Wilcox, had butted heads continually from the first moment they met. They became enemies on the mountain and became worse enemies after. Howard wrote a book which amplified the earlier criticisms that said Joe Wilcox really caused this disaster and the inexperience of his teammates. It was called The Hall of the Mountain King, and it was published about 6 years after the expedition. And it helped to cement the misconception, really, that Joe and the climbers did things that resulted in their own deaths. 14 years later, Joe published a book of his own in self-defense called White Winds, but it was really too little too late. And by that time, consensus in the mountaineering community had solidified to the extent that, as I mentioned earlier, that this was something that Joe caused. All five men went on to healthy, you know, families and careers, and I've visited all of them in the course of my research. They spread out through the West, actually. And it was a fascinating experience interviewing them, because they all opened their diaries to me and their journals and showed me their slides and things like that. And what struck me most was how much all of them are still carrying the pain of that experience with them today.
I imagine so. Jim Tabor, his new book is Forever on the Mountain. And we should point out that there are some really horrific photographs in the book that these men took up on the mountain of the men who died.
Yeah, that's right. There's one photograph that's so compelling. Some climbers who were functioning as a de facto rescue team got close to the high camp, they found the body of one young man. His name was John Russell, and clearly he had died while huddling in his tent, with the tent collapsed, tent wrapped around him like a shroud. And they found him frozen to death, sitting up, and it was just a terribly, terribly wrenching sight. And there is a photograph of that in the book. Unfortunately, they themselves were attacked by a storm equally vicious but a little bit shorter, and so they were not able to retrieve the bodies, to bring the bodies that they spotted down with them. When a larger expedition went up 2 weeks later, everything was gone. Either had been blown away or buried. So there were no traces after that.
My God. And of course, some folks listening may be wondering, was there any cannibalism? Because you often hear in situations like this, there's some cannibalism. But I don't think that was the case here, right?
No, I don't. I think absolutely not. For one thing, they were trapped for 10 days. And so they weren't there long enough for, I think, that kind of ravenous hunger to have been a problem. What would have been much more a problem for them would have been water and dehydration. Because once you run out of fuel to run your little stove and melt snow for water, then you just begin to dehydrate at an amazing rate. And eating snow, it just doesn't help. It can't help. So water, really, rather than nutrition, would have been the killer for them.
Jim, now you're a mountaineer yourself, and you've been on McKinley. What's it like?
First of all, the thing that hits you immediately is the size of the darn thing. I mean, I lived in Colorado for a while, and I climbed 14ers out there, and I've been in the Alps too. But you look at McKinley, and it is staggering, the size of it. It's massif, as they say, is more than twice that of Mount Everest. In other words, it's just its overall size. And you know, if you climb Everest, this is a good statistic here. You climb 10,000 feet. The base camp is at 19. The summit is at 29. When you climb McKinley, you climb 18,000 feet because you start at 2,000 and you top out at 20.
Oh,
so it's twice the vertical climb that Everest is, and the scale of everything is what just stuns you at first when you get up there. Beyond that, the viciousness and the changeability of the weather is the second striking thing. I mean, when I was there, we were hit by storms that came in with 10 minutes notice or less. And when I asked Howard Snyder, one of the survivors, who was at 16,000 feet, I said, Howard, how quickly did that big storm hit you? He clapped his hands really loudly in my face, and he said, that fast, Jim. That's how it came in.
Wow.
So, you know, scale and weather certainly are the two things that really really stun you up there.
Yeah, really quick, I got about a minute left, but I just wanted to ask you about, you know, today we got the GPS and, you know, IMAX crews are up on top of these mountains. It's
right.
Just they make it sound and look so easy, but what has been the legacy of what happened, what you write about, what happened in 1967 on McKinley in terms of the impact on all the climbs around the world on the mountaineering community?
Sure. Well, I will tell you that these days, Mount McKinley, Denali National Park, has by far the best search and rescue operation of any place on Earth. And it's a direct descendant of that 1967 tragedy, which kind of began the development. And I think that trend really bled over all around the world now. So most of the major popular climbing sites that are administered by government agencies have these kinds of capabilities. And it was those seven men who had to die, unfortunately, to trigger that development.
It is an amazing story. Jim, thank you so much for writing this and in the years you spent researching this. The book is Forever on the Mountain, author Jim Tabor. Thank you so much, Jim. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks, Coy. Me too. Take care now.
This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com.
You've been listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To participate in the program, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, sevillepodcast.com.